What's it like to cruise aboard LST 325 for a month? I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with author Chris Underwood. His latest book has the old warship doing battle with a new enemy at Niagara Falls. Underwood volunteered in the wheelhouse on a recent journey along the mighty Mississippi. We'll share his experiences, including a stormy night and dodging busy barge traffic. Also, women are now part of the crew, and what was on the menu at the ship's galley. And we'll relive my days on LST 325 as it left Aurora, Indiana, headed downriver back to its home port in Evansville. Life aboard an LST, and a glimpse into the new action-filled book, The Cold Winter, The Battle of Niagara Falls. 2 Main Street is next, presented by the Berger Wren Group at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. The author of the Cold Winter Trilogy is back with another new book in the series and is here to share his experiences aboard LST 325. Chris Underwood's new book is The Cold Winter, Battle of Niagara Falls, where LST 325 is a key player, along with a P-47 Thunderbolt. The book is described as a nonstop thrill ride on an old school roller coaster. So, Chris Underwood, welcome back to 2 Main Street. Evansville has become kind of your second home, right?
It has. It really has. I've been spending a lot of time here, and I've made a lot of friends, and so I have places to stay.
Well, before we talk about the new book, Cold Winter Battle Niagara Falls, which is a great title, take us on board the old World War II ship for that fall 2025 cruise, the Mississippi River journey. You were part of the crew, right?
Yes. I was part of the wheelhouse crew. I helped to assist the captain, and we helped to motor the boat. The captain is only steering the boat, and he still has to call down through the tube and tell the engine crew or the wheelhouse crew to what speed he wants the engine to be going, and for the starboard engine, port engine, he would call down the commands and we would make it so.
Really? Now, where all did you go on this journey?
We went down the Ohio River to where it met the Mississippi, which was a really cool joining of the two rivers. And then we went upstream the Mississippi to Muscatine, Iowa, and that was our first stop. So we went to our furthest destination, which took us 6 days.
Really?
Yes. And then we came back downstream, heading home, and stopped at Alton, Illinois, which is in St. Louis, a St. Louis suburb, and then Cape Girardeau.
Mm-hmm. Now, the first stop, Muscatine, Iowa. I did some research on that. The pearl button capital of the world. They used to harvest pearls from mussels and to make these buttons, and this was very big business in the early 1900s. And you also told me that that was the watermelon capital for a while.
Yes. They're in town along the riverfront. They have a statue of a man. I don't know, harvesting these buttons. But then also they have a big statue of a watermelon as well.
Okay. So what was the reception in Muscatine? How many people showed up? Did you have a good crowd?
It was a really good crowd. We had a lot of folks showing up for that. I was pleasantly surprised. Pleasantly mm-hmm. surprised. It was very good. And a neat little town, too.
Now, you were also signing books, too, on the ship?
Yes. I signed books for our three stops. And during those three weekends, I sold 1,400 books.
Really?
Yes.
Did you have that many with you?
I did. Actually, wow. I had many more. Because, you know, the last thing you want to do is run out.
Oh, well, then you're just kind of sitting there,
so,
hi, folks.
Yes, right. So I had more than we needed, and mm-hmm. then we had to work to get them out of there at the end of the trip, too, which was not a fun job.
Okay. Now, Now, Alton, Illinois, there's a state park, Pere Marquette State Park, just north of there along the Mississippi. And there's a beautiful roadway right along the Mississippi River. And you can, on the cliffs there.
Yes.
That's a beautiful stretch of river.
I have heard a little bit about it. Actually, one of our crew members brought his bicycle along the right.
Oh, really?
And the ship, and he went for a ride along that.
Yeah, it's so a river road there, I think.
Yes, very, he told very me some famous. Good stories about it. It was very nice.
Cape Girardeau, I've been there. The ship has been there before, and they have a kind of a real long kind of dress a plaza, I guess, for yes. the ship to dock there.
Right, right. And they have a river wall, a flood wall, mm-hmm.
yeah.
that kind of blocks viewing of the facade there. But mm-hmm. it was really neat. I went in for a walk around the town a little bit. Some mm-hmm. neat old architecture. Really nice.
So what was the visitor's reaction to the ship?
Oh, it was really great. It was really great. They really applauded us for keeping that history alive. Mm-hmm. There were actually some folks who weren't really sure how we got it there, asking if we had it towed or what. And but no, it ran by its own power to get there and all of that. So there were great response from people.
Now, so you spent 3 weeks.
It was actually four.
4 weeks.
Four
on
weeks
the ship.
Can when you include our original 6 days of getting to our first destination.
Right. Right. Now I spent 3 days on one of the cruises. We went from Aurora, Indiana, back down to Evansville, and I know I enjoyed going out on the deck in the evening. It's kind of magical, isn't it, when you're on the ship
yes.
at night, trying to imagine being on that World War II ship during World War II.
Yes, and actually, you know, at night when it's moving mm-hmm. Along the river, it just glides along, and you're just looking at the stars and everything. We had beautiful weather.
Really good.
Yes.
No storms.
Weather. No, no. Well, we did have a couple of storms. I do remember that. When I was actually working in the wheelhouse and we were running through a storm, you could see the light, the sky would light up on us and we could see that the storm was coming in. It was before it started to rain that you could really see the clouds and the storm moving towards us as we're getting.
Now, was there a lot of river traffic on the Mississippi?
There really was. There was a lot of river traffic, a lot of barges going through. And also the waterway is very large. I mean, it's really wide, but the channel is not that. You have to be very careful about it. It's very narrow, and there were areas where you had to actually move aside to let the barge through. There are points where we wouldn't. There just wasn't enough room for both the curves and everything else.
What did the other river traffic think about the ship?
Oh yes, they were really into it. The barges would blow their horn at us, and mm-hmm. We would communicate back. And like I said, I was in the wheelhouse, and also I accompanied the captain. I would keep the captain company at night and go get him coffee or whatever he needed to have, and so I could hear the communications of the mm-hmm. The radio back and forth to the other towboats, and they were. Having some remarkable things to say. Really, really proud to see us going by.
Well, who was the captain?
Well, we had multiple captains, but I mean the captain of the ship, Captain Bob. I can't think of his last name off the top of my head
Just Captain Bob.
Captain Bob.
That's everybody knew him as.
But Captain Bob. And then we also had other pilots that would come in to relieve.
Right.
Because they would only have me captaining the ship for, I don't know if it was a 4 hour or 6 hour shift. Mm-hmm. But so they had other captains that had volunteered, and they had a variety of backgrounds. A lot of them were towboat captains.
Right.
It had to be rated for that size of a ship and that sort of thing. But also there was a guy that had a history of running a casino boat.
Oh, really?
Yes. So he had some good stories for me, things that had occurred with that. And with the towboat captains, there were some things that I could actually use in my writing. The casino boat captain, Al, there wasn't really anything. too many varied stories.
I bet. Now, I'm curious. Now, I know on the Ohio River, a lot of locks and dams.
Yes.
Were there any on the Mississippi?
Yes, there were. You had to get to St. Louis first. So we had to go all the way up to St. Louis before we hit any locks.
Mm-hmm.
And also on the way up there. So because of that, without the locks controlling the river, it had much more of a current to it.
Really?
So we were fighting a current to get to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And we were only going about 3.5 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah, you're going upriver there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But coming back downstream, we had the benefit of that.
Mm-hmm. Any moments on there where it got kind of tricky?
There were some tricky moments. Yes. Yeah. Well, like I said, we had to pull aside for other traffic,
mm-hmm.
Just to be careful with the curves and the thing out, other things in the river. But also, there was a time when one of our generators was having a difficulty to switch back and forth. Because you know, we have four different generators for power aboard the ship, and they wanted them to be able to switch from each other. Mm-hmm. So we had pulled aside and just pushed up onto the side of the river with a flat bottom boat. You have that ability to be able to just stop and get the generator going, and make sure that we could get the two of them connected well.
We're talking to Chris Underwood. He's the author of Cold Winter, The Battle of Niagara Falls. He was a crew member aboard the LST 325 on its recent cruise on the Mississippi River. Were there many veterans among the crew?
Yes, yes. I would say about half really? Of the crew were veterans. The other half were folks who had a veteran member of the family, maybe that had been on an LST in the past. And so they wanted to try to, relive that a little bit, or maybe you just wanting to keep that history alive.
I know there was a break room on the ship. I think there was coffee 24/7 in break room. And that's where I'm sure some stories are told.
Yes, yes, yes.
Did you get some material there?
Yeah, yeah. That was the great place to be able to talk to folks. And and also in addition to the coffee, I also have an ice cream machine.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, when I was on the ship, they didn't have
that. Oh, yeah.
Unless they hit it, I don't know.
That was the popular thing, the soft serve ice cream. I sat with a few crew members getting stories, and there was actually one person who was aboard who had his father's journal.
From when he was
in the war.
Oh, really?
And so he was transcribing that journal, that diary.
Of course, LST 325 has a great history, and that's retold during these stops when the visitors come on board.
Mm-hmm.
What's the brief history of the ship in World War II?
Well, the main history was that it transported crew. It actually did land on the beach of Normandy. On the second day, it didn't land on the first day. It landed on the second day. It didn't have tanks aboard. It had trucks and supplies that rolled out. And then once it did that landing, then it retracted its anchor and pulled back out into the water again and went for another load.
Mm-hmm. And I know it also transported, I think, the wounded troops and prisoners.
Yes.
At one time, too.
Yes, yes. I brought in some prisoners. A lot of those, I haven't gotten a lot of that story, well, all of those stories anyway, mm-hmm. of the D-Day landings, but I do know some.
But the ship survived the war.
Yes.
I know it had a couple of moments where it was hit by enemy fire.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, they have some holes in the deck that have been covered back over, but they have painted them red so that people can see them,
okay.
See where they are.
Right.
And also when it rains, the deck is not completely watertight. We have found that out. We would have to have some buckets here and there.
So it pools up on the deck there.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. So You actually, I guess, swab the deck, really.
Right.
To clean it. Okay. Now, during your current visit to Evansville, during the Veterans Day ceremonies, you've been a busy guy. What have you been doing in Evansville?
Yes, I had a I did a presentation at the Newburgh Museum on Monday, talking about my experiences with the ship and my method writing technique of experiencing things to write about them, and it really helps me to be able to get the right words and descriptions of things to be able to, from experiencing them. And I also have just yesterday I spoke at the Evansville Rotary Luncheon. That was a great opportunity to talk about the LST. I think there was about 100-150 people who were there in attendance at the luncheon.
What questions did they have?
Oh, it was all over the place. asking about, you know, my writing technique and things like that. If I have to get away from everyone, and I really do. I need to have some space. During my writing of my most recent book, I just took off for a month and stayed in a cabin there in Tell City at the Blue Heron Winery, at one of their little cabins there in the vineyard. That was a great little retreat to be able to have some space to write.
That's a neat place too, overlooking the Ohio River.
It is.
Get some inspiration there.
They have a great view and a view of the Kennelton Lock there as well.
Oh yeah, that's right. Now there's a Girl Scout camp right down there by the Kennelton Lock, Camp Cook.
Oh really?
Yeah. And so my wife, she's with the Girl Scouts, and we go there a lot on retreats. So that's a beautiful area there.
Yes, yes.
And also they have the Celtic cross there.
Right. It's carved out of a stone that's just a part of the mountain.
Mm-hmm. And of course the Blue Heron Winery makes an appearance in your latest book.
It does.
Reference.
It does. Just a little bit. Just throw a little paragraph in there.
Do they know about that?
I don't believe so.
Oh, you'll have to let me know.
That's
that.
Right.
What page number it's on. Okay. All right. My guest is Chris Underwood, author of the Cold Winter Book Series, Book 3, and the new book also feature LST 325, back in action again, armed and ready to get back in the fight, but with a new enemy, of course. Even the Evansville-made P-47 Thunderbolt makes an appearance in the new book, Back in the Air, ready for a new bombing mission. We're going to hear more about that and more about Chris's writing style coming up. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is author Chris Underwood. His new book is Cold Winter, Battle of Niagara Falls, When Evansville's LST 325 and a vintage P-47 Thunderbolt are called back to duty to battle a new enemy. There are also some old Huey helicopters and Cobra choppers, I think, in the action. Yes. And as a writer, Chris, I know you try to live the experience, and your writing style, we talked something about that. You like to, I guess, get involved in these topics. And you've flown on these choppers. Now you've ridden on the ship. Tell me about that.
Yes. I volunteer with a Huey helicopter group called the Army Aviation Heritage Foundation. They have two bases, one in Louisville and one in Atlanta. And when I was researching the book, I just showed up at one of their air shows. I think the Dayton Air Show. They were doing rides, and my main focus was just to ride on a Huey helicopter and feel that adrenaline, that experience of it. And they do a great job of it, actually, also, of giving you that feel of a more of a military operation, where you would, when you buy your ticket to ride on the Huey, they would bring together the 10 people who are going to be riding on the helicopter, and they define who's going to be sitting where, and they get it all taken care of on the ground in a tent, and then when the chopper is ready, they run us out there, lock us in, and then take off quick. Just like going on a mission.
And you have that open air area there where they have the machine guns.
Yes, it's completely open, and you get that real adrenaline rush of taking off with it and going on the ride. And so when I did the first meeting with them, you know, I saw them there at Dayton, and I just didn't leave their tent. I just kept on staying, just talking, you know, and I talked to anybody that would talk to me and tell me stories. And I found some pilots who were on break and talked to them a little bit. And eventually they kind of took me under their wing and invited me to come back again. And so I volunteered with them for some other air shows. I went to the Owensboro Air Show and a couple other air shows around, and was able to learn a lot of things and talk with the pilots. I had to find a pilot who had served in a cold weather environment, because Huey, you may normally see it in a over a lush forest and that sort of thing.
Right.
So
right.
So finding one in a cold environment, I found a pilot who had served in Alaska. And so he had some good stories for me. Mm-hmm. And that was really good, being able to show me some different things of what they had to worry about, the things they had to be concerned with cold weather.
Now, you grew up in Ohio, is that right?
Yes.
You're Ohio native. Yeah. When did you start writing professionally?
About 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
15 years. And it took me quite a while in the first book. It was a few years. I had joined... So a writing group that was sponsored by a publisher, and we would send chapters back and forth to each other, get different critiques, and you know, not that the other writers knew everything, but it was good to have a good critique from somebody who is objective.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. And how would you describe your form of fiction?
Oh yeah, character driven. Mm-hmm. And also more of a adventure
right.
driven.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I like to dig into the character and what's going on in their mind a little bit. And
I know action is a big part of your narrative.
It is, and I try to be able to paint a picture in the person's mind of what's all is going on,
mm-hmm.
which is the great thing about writing. You don't need to hire a producer or a film crew or have a budget. You just need to create it in the person's mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have like a notebook you write down things?
I do. I try to keep notes, and when an idea comes to me, I'll jot it down. I also use my phone, my voice recorder in the phone.
Okay.
And when an idea comes to me, I do a lot of driving, obviously. Mm-hmm. I bang forth to Evansville and to other book shows and all that sort of thing. So I do a lot through my voice recorder, and then I'll play it back to myself and try to get those thoughts into the story.
Now, you talked about your writing retreat. You just kind of got away from everybody, mm-hmm. and just sat down and just wrote every day. How many hours a day would you write?
Oh, at least 8 hours a day.
Really?
I had a good regimen to my system of it. I would have to do some marketing things and that sort mm-hmm. of stuff. I would do that in the morning because you know morning is pretty much wasted. I'm not a good writer in the morning, so then I would get into the afternoon, about mid afternoon, and then switch over to doing creative writing, and usually that would go until midnight or later.
Mm-hmm. Coffee drinker?
Yes. Okay. But then I try to put that away at around 2 o'clock, or it just makes me too much.
Okay. Now, of course, you've come back and forth to Evansville. So what's been your fascination with Evansville's World War II history?
It has so much going on to it, so it really helps to try to bring some of that out.
Now, the shipyard, of course, turned out 167 LSTs during World War II. So there's I guess, a kind of a ghostly presence here of the ships that have come and gone on the Ohio River. So great history for the Evansville area.
Yeah, and it was right at the end of the hairpin turn
right,
of the
yeah,
river.
Yeah. Now let's go back to life on the ship. What was your daily routine when the ship was on the move?
We would be working 4 hours on and then 12 hours off, and that would go around the clock. So there would be, you'd have a night shift and a day shift every day. So it was very trying. There was lots of sleep lost.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Yeah, you don't get much sleep on that ship. It's noisy.
It's very noisy.
It is
very noisy. You know, and then when we're coming into the locks, you know, then you're, you know, you got banging and all sorts of things going on. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult. And then I went and made it even more difficult for myself by continuing to work on this latest book that I had turned it into my editor, about 3 or 4 weeks before the trip. And then we were going back and forth, you know, crunching through and, pounding on that first draft. And so I was still editing it while we were aboard the ship.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And I had a deadline, and it was a lot of work. Mm-hmm. It was too much. I had piled too much on myself.
So you weren't in a hammock somewhere,
That's
daydreaming.
Right.
You were working.
I was working on the ship, and then also working on the book, and it was very trying.
Okay. Now, what were the meals like in the galley there?
We had very good food. Very good. They really took care of us there. Mm-hmm. That was for sure. And there were times it would always seem like that I would miss out on my favorite breakfast, which is biscuits and gravy. I'd always miss out on that by my shift being.
Of course. Yeah. So they didn't bring it up to the wheelhouse too.
No, or that I would be sleeping through it because
that's true.
I had worked. I just gotten off shift at 4 a.m. and I'm missing breakfast. So,
what was the typical dinner? What would you have for dinner?
Yeah, lots of different things. They had pork chops, and they tried to stay with the staples. You know, they knew who their audience was.
Okay.
You know,
okay. So, meat and potatoes,
you know,
guys.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Any women on the crew?
There were. There was only they'd only been able to do that in the last few years. They had been able to fix up another crew area.
Sure.
And so that was really the problem before. They didn't have a second crew space. So now that they have that, there was, handful of maybe about five or six women, a couple that were wives of other crew members.
Were they working? Were they working too?
Yes, yes. Mainly in the galley, mm-hmm. But yes.
Okay. Well, I know they had to have a separate area because when I was on there, men would go back and forth through the shower, and they wouldn't. They'd have like a towel. Maybe they wouldn't wear a towel. They'd be walking around naked down there by the sleeping area. So yeah, you have to have a separate area. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Wild times.
Okay. Now the history. We talked about the history of the LST 325, D-Day trips across the English Channel. Also became part of the Greek Navy. And then there's some talk of maybe it was a spy ship. Is that right, Chris?
Yes, yes. There is a conspiracy theory, you know, because it was given to the Greek Navy in the 80s, mm-hmm. and the radio room was expanded to double the size that it would than when it was given to them.
And why would that happen?
Hmm. Yes, yes. So it was rumored that it was at least a listening ship. But also, they believe that it was also might have been a broadcasting ship for the for Radio Free Europe, and that would have meant that it had been very important to the Wall of Berlin.
Yeah, this is the Cold War.
Yes, it's all
Cold War.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. And so actually, I use that that conspiracy theory in my story.
Okay,
as it would compare to the main thing that the Radio Free Europe did. Was it would put out an opposing viewpoint of the Russian propaganda that was being put on the radio, mm-hmm. because all that Hungary and all these other different areas were receiving was a Russian viewpoint, and so there was a broadcast that would give a different viewpoint, and that helped to change people's minds, and it also kind of comes into where we are today when you compare. The different viewpoints of different news sources, mm-hmm. that are coming out today. So I tried to bring that that comparison into my story.
Of course, then the Greek Navy kind of, I guess, mothballs the ship, LST-325.
Yes.
It is has new life, sailed back to the U.S., had to get special permission to get back into the United States waters, of course.
Well, they kind of pushed their way through that, too. They flew a pirate flag for a while.
Okay.
Well, because they didn't really have all the permissions that they needed to have.
But they got back
yes.
to Mobile, Alabama, had a spot there. I know I saw the ship when it came back. It was in pretty rough shape. Rust and everything.
They just made it. They worked on it for a few months there in the Greek shipyard to make it seaworthy. Mm-hmm. And the LST Foundation they purchased it from them for the value of scrap metal.
Right.
And that was, I guess that was another thing that in my tours recently last month, they. People were thinking that this was a government-owned or government-operated ship, but it's not. It is completely privately owned, and they had to actually purchase it from the Greek Navy, mm-hmm. and bring it across, and they have to pay for everything that happens to it, all the upgrades and all the work that's being done to it.
And one of the people involved in that, Captain Bob Jorlin, the late Captain Bob Jorlin, was very instrumental in bringing the ship back and restoring it, and eventually getting it to Evansville, its new home port. My guest is author Chris Underwood. His new book is Book 4 in the Cold Winter series, Cold Winter, Battle of Niagara Falls. We're going to get into the plot next. And I understand, why Niagara Falls? I'm curious there. I know there's a great scenery there, of course. A lot of obstacles to
yes,
avoid.
Yes, yes. And I visited the Niagara Falls during last January during a really bad snowstorm.
Okay.
And I tell you what, if you want to feel some cold, that's one way to do it. But no, the story is based upon the Niagara Falls power grid being taken over by an enemy. And so what we're doing here in this story is taking it back,
mm-hmm.
and trying to bring the series to a full circle here by bringing the lights back on.
Right. That's the whole idea of the cold winter.
Yes,
when the power grid went down and people had to survive the cold winter any way they could. Also, we're going to talk about the P-47 Thunderbolt, what role it plays in the new book. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is author Chris Underwood. His new book is Cold Winter, The Battle of Niagara Falls, part of the Cold Winter book series, When the Power Grid Goes Down and Our High-Tech Society Has to Go Old School. When modern engines are unreliable, victory will require unconventional and historical means. That opens the door to rearming some vintage war machines, including the LST-325 and the P-47 Thunderbolt. What role does the plane play in the new book, Chris?
Yes. So we meet some people who do more air shows. I get into a lot of my characters, my heroes are air show people. So I kind of bring in my knowledge that I have from air shows. And so they notice that there's this P-47 there in the hangar. And he said, well, he flies it every so often when an air show can afford the insurance.
Right.
Because it's a very expensive plane. But he does have a couple of bombs he could put on it. But he also mentions he hasn't had much experience at live dropping of a bomb, but he thinks that he could do something with it. It is a very limited bombing mission, but he has some fun with it.
That's what the P-47 did in World War II, these bombing missions, taking out railroads, mm-hmm. Depots and locomotives and, I guess, ammunition depots in the occupied Europe. Back to book one, the Great Lakes region is kind of your focus there.
Yes.
The power grid's down. Neighbors band together to survive the cold winter, but there's also a government takeover, a lot going on. So who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, Chris?
The
militia's the good guys, right?
The militias are the good guys, and actually they are a civilian militia that are being given orders by a Division of Homeland Security. So it's kind of a Bourne Identity kind of thing. We have this secret little faction of Homeland Security that is operating through these civilian militias. But the bad guys now, the bad guys are China, mm-hmm. trying to come over and take us over.
Okay. Now, how does the LST 325 get involved?
One of the civilian militias takes over the LST 325, mainly because some of the members of that militia are volunteers on the ship. So they know about the ship, they know how to run it, and so it kind of brings in some of the crew that I've worked with on the ship. I don't really bring out any particular member that I volunteered with, but
mm-hmm. Now in book 3, I know there's a rescue mission. That was very exciting. In book 4, we talked about the battleground being Niagara Falls, a lot of drama there. Of course, not only attacking the enemy there, but dealing with Mother Nature. and so we did a lot of research at Niagara Falls. Is the Peace Bridge involved up there?
It is. It is. Well, without giving away too much of the story, mm-hmm. an ice dam is created around the Peace Bridge.
Oh.
Yes, yes. So it kind of has, so we actually have a scene of Niagara Falls running dry.
Oh.
Yeah, so it has happened in the past. It has
true.
Happened in the past with ice dams.
Okay. Now, also you mentioned Knoxville, Kentucky in the new book. I thought that was very interesting, the Appalachian area. Why Knoxville, Kentucky?
It's a good location within 300 miles of where the ship is at, where the LST is at, because we have to Huey helicopter can only fly about 300 miles on a tank of gas. So I'm trying to work in. I tried to keep as realistic as possible. So I kind of moved my air show people from Atlanta to Knoxville.
Okay, and of course that's remote.
Yes. And it's still in the powered zone where the power
I noticed
is still going.
In your book, you don't really go to big cities. It's these smaller towns that are involved, and that's where the militia can organize,
right.
And I guess kind of go under the radar.
Right, in the heartland.
That's right, that's right. Knoxville, Kentucky, the cradle of country music.
Yes.
Roy Acuff, Chet Atkins, Flat Scruggs, and Dolly Parton. Started their early careers in Knoxville, Kentucky.
Yeah,
love these little side stories. Okay, now the action begins after a speech by the vice president, and is it a call to action?
Yes, where he's just he's saying that he's actually announcing to the world that he's actually alive. There had been through the whole story that he didn't make it to the bunker in Virginia where the vice president is supposed to go during an emergency, but he has managed to stay alive, and that's who they are. That's the VIP that they are trying to rescue.
Now, some of the protagonists in the book, Tom is still involved, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
T-H-O-M.
Yes. Yes,
we meet him in book 1.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he does he lose a limb or something?
Yes, yes, he loses a leg eventually through the story.
But he survives and okay, he's a good one in this book. Okay. And now
I keep him going. Yeah, torture the poor guy. I torture him.
Yeah, you really do, but he comes back. Now, you have a dedication in the book to I guess all veterans, don't you?
Yes, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I felt that was definitely necessary, especially after all that I had all I'd seen with the latest tour with the LST.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Chris Underwood, you have 4 books now in the Cold Winter series. What's next? Is there a 5?
Well, like I said, I'm trying to bring the series full circle, with trying to get the lights turned back on, And then we would go into a recovery. And what can go wrong in a recovery?
Of course. Yeah. No, of course, we have some of the action in book three. I know you had a lot of battles going on in the locks and dams. And the bad guys had taken those over. And so the LST and its crew would take these locks and dams back.
Right.
Out of action there. And we make our way up to Niagara Falls. The history of Niagara Falls, too, I mean, that's always been kind of a strategic area. Do the Canadians play a role in this?
They do not. No.
Okay.
No, I try to keep it on the U.S. side. Although I do have a group of reenactors because there is a large reenactment that happens each year up there at Fort Niagara,
mm-hmm.
and it's a beautiful fort, by the way, just mm-hmm. beautiful. And they do some reenactments of the War of 1812. Up there, so they have a combination of all of the French and English and Indians and everything, and so I have a group of reenactors who have felt that the fort would be a good place to ride out the disaster.
Okay,
and so they come into play.
Now, Captain Murdoch, is that the commander of the LST 325 in your book?
Yes, he is.
Well, tell me about Captain Murdoch. What kind of character is he?
He is a true patriot, and he wants to protect the ship. The ship is his main goal. He doesn't really even believe that there is a war going on. You know, there's all kinds of different information out there on the airwaves. So if his ship is going to be taken by this civilian militia, that he wanted to be able to be in command of it and protect it.
Well, it's a floating museum.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
and he respects the history of the ship.
Right, right.
But he's also kind of, I guess, going kicking and screaming that it's going to be armed again and put in harm's way.
Right. It's going to be put in harm's way. And then now in the fourth book, as they're coming back down the river, there is the weather is starting to get warmer. The snow, all the ice melt is getting into the river. The river is getting high. And so it's actually going over some of the locks and dams. It has gotten so high, even higher than the 48 feet that we had this year.
Right. Well, I mean, when you read the book, there's a lot of locations that folks around here would recognize. Of course, you mentioned going through the locks and dams at Louisville. And then you go down to Leavenworth, mm-hmm. Indiana. And then we go to Candleton. And
yes,
then,
yes.
You mentioned going past Owensboro. And then the Newburgh,
yes.
And then pulling back into Evansville. So a lot of familiar spots there. It's and a lot of action in the book. And so do you have some ideas on another one?
I do. The
I know you said maybe the post.
Right. So a recovery. So, yeah, so I think that's what makes my story different than all the other apocalyptic stories that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not complete devastation. We're not put back to plowing our fields with oxen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a disaster that's ongoing for 3 months, and now we are trying to come back and try to recover from it. So, I just have a general idea of where I'm wanting to go with it. I kind of want to study some of the other recoveries of disasters that we have gone through. Possibly look at Katrina a little bit, look at some of the other disasters that we've had. But at this point, I'm looking forward to taking a break from writing. I pushed myself way too hard on the LST. And so I'm looking forward to doing some reading of other books in my genre and things like that. But I will get back to it probably by mid-year and look into what a recovery would look like.
What do you like to read? Who do you like to read?
I'm a Clive Cussler fan.
Okay.
That kind of shows in my adventure mm-hmm. writing story mm-hmm. type. Also, you know, from my younger years, Ian Fleming was my absolute favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And I have enjoyed the other local writer here in Evansville.
Wicker.
Yes. He had a real Ian Fleming kind of flair to his mm-hmm. style of writing.
What advice do you have to would-be writers?
Is just
I know
to,
you were a would-be writer at one
yes,
time.
Yes, is to write, not just think about it. I've had a lot of other would-be writers talk to me about things, and my best advice is to get it out of your head and get it on paper, and get it in front of some people. I think that the route that I took of working with a writer's group is really a great way to go about it. You're just exchanging some chapters. You know, you have to put some time into it yourself of reading other people's work and giving critiques of their work as well. And actually, there's a group right here in Evansville, the Midwest Writers Group, that is a good option for somebody who's local.
My thanks to author Chris Underwood, and congratulations on the new book, Chris.
Cold
Winter, The Battle of Niagara Falls. It's a great read. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Author Chris Underwood donates a portion of the sale of his books to the operation of LST 325. In the fall of 2019, I spent a few days aboard LST 325. Here's my report as the old warship left Aurora, Indiana, and headed downriver to its home port in Evansville. Welcome aboard. I'm David James, and this is a special edition of Two Main Street from the main deck of LST 325. The World War II ship has been lovingly restored and is the only fully operational LST on U.S. waters. The ship makes annual river cruises, and we just left Aurora, Indiana. Aurora, by the way, about a day and a half trip upriver from LST 325's home port on the Evansville Riverfront. LST 325, of course, a survivor of combat during World War II, taking part in Operation Husky in the invasion of Italy, Operation Avalanche in the invasion of Salerno, and Operation, of course, Overlord, the invasion of Normandy. LST 325 also survived the scrap heap, so many of the ships were dismantled, others sunk in target practice. Evansville, of course, closely tied to the LST because 167 of them slid down the ramp at the Evansville shipyard, which at one time had as many as 19,000 workers. LST 325 was actually built in Philadelphia and commissioned in 1942. Well, I have been granted permission to come aboard, and my host is Chris Donahue. So, Chris, it's always exciting to see visitors on board LST 325 and the reaction.
Oh, yeah, it is. Well, there are hundreds of reactions. I mean, we probably did, 8,000 people, something like that, in those 4 days, 5 days. So I can't even start to talk about reactions. Everything from school kids to a 106-year-old person, come on. But that's why we do what we do. We're show-offs, and that's what we get out of it.
And I was excited to talk to all the people on board, the crew, of course, a colorful crew always aboard LST 325.
Yeah, you can call it colorful. They're colorful, all right. You talk about 5 weeks on this ship. You've been on it a day and a half,
that's
maybe.
Right.
And you get the feeling, you saw the luxurious sleeping facilities.
Sure.
Sleeping with, about
sleep, a relative word. I didn't do much sleeping
right.
last night, really.
And you won't till you get home. But,
well, listen, right now we just went under a bridge here. We're looking at the scenery here. Just wooded areas on both sides of the river. A few homes dotted here and there.
If it weren't for the trees on the beach, we wouldn't know if we're moving. You know, if they're moving by us, we know what LST, the crew in World War II would tell you LST stands for Large Slow Target, our last ship there. Because right now we're probably doing a little over 9 mile an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And in the war, fully loaded with 20 tanks, 30 trucks, you're at 4,000 tons, probably somewhere between 5 and 8 mile an hour on a good day. So,
now, what are some of the frequently asked questions when people tour the ship, Chris?
Well, on this trip, it was kind of funny because people say, how'd you get this ship here? And you don't laugh because some of them are serious. Did you put it on a flatbed or tow it up? And so, well, we drove it here, we piloted it here. And then you get that deer in the headlight look like, no, we really did. Come back on Monday night about 8 p.m. and you'll see us pull away. And they did. They were out there. A lot of people ask about Normandy because everybody, if you don't know a lot about World War II, you've heard of D-Day, June 6, 1944. Of course, this ship was there. They say, oh, so this was at Normandy, and of course there's a couple of holes we can show them from German aircraft. That didn't happen at Normandy, but North Africa. And then we go back, but before Normandy, it was at North Africa, then Sicily, then Salerno, and then Normandy. And a lot of people have heard of Omaha Beach. That's where this ship was. So we're blessed to have the last one standing that has that kind of history behind it. Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of these crew members are historians in their own right. They have a lot of history, a lot of experience being on this ship.
Oh, too. Yes. Two of the guys on here are 93, 93 and a half. Well, the one guy turned 93 and a half on the ship. They baked him a cake. And he says, well, when you hit 90, halves count. So we got two of them on here that I know of, and a whole bunch of guys, Vietnam era. A lot of these guys, on they were on LSTs in Vietnam. Yeah, you can get a lot of stories on here.
Of course, Evansville, I'm very fortunate to have LST 325. Of course, Evansville has a rich history involving the ship with the Evansville Shipyard, and they really cranked those ships out.
Oh, yeah. They're, like I said, they produce more than any other one shipyard in the country. The next number two was we had 167. Seneca, Illinois had 157. And they probably got, maybe 3,000 people up there, so that's kind of mind-boggling, too. Mm-hmm. But, Evansville, as everybody knows, of course, we made 96% of the .45 caliber ammunition. And I'm kind of going off on tangents here, but it's all intertwined. The most LSTs, the most ammo, .45 caliber, and a whole bunch of .30 caliber. So it's mind-boggling what Evansville did during the war.
I think it's, I really got from my time on the ship where we're cruising, I mean, it just makes it special. I mean, you can see it have a static museum where you can go visit and everything. This is a floating museum.
Right.
And a working ship.
You can go to Muskegon, Michigan and see the LST 393. It was a car ferry. It's got openings on each side where cars come and go. And that's a great, it was at Normandy alongside this one, but it's not quite the same. So right now we have bragging rights, only one in the world. The other guys, they got museums and they're cool. So our goal is to keep this a sailing museum and showing it off around the eastern U.S. inland rivers as long as we can.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street on your public radio station, WNIN-FM.